I was born on November 18, 1916 in Vienna. My father had always remained a Czech citizen, having been born in Czechoslovakia, formerly under the years of Masaryk. But he decided for economic reasons to remain a Czech citizen. So later on, when I was sent to London to perfect English, I found out, notified by the Czech consulate, that I was supposed to join the Czech army. I was therefore returned to Vienna and then to Prague and had to learn Czech, because in order to go in as an officer candidate, I had to repeat what we called the matura. Otherwise, you would go in as a soldier. And unlike the US Army, it's not that easy to advance from soldier status. And I did go back and I did repeat my matura. The only thing was, by that time, to the misfortune of the Czechs, but in a way my good fortune, the German army marched into Prague in 1938, and the army was dissolved. And I had an American visa, which fortunately my foresighted brother-in-law had applied for in Vienna, and the quota for a Czech citizen in Vienna was wide open. So therefore I had that visa. And now I was, all I needed was to get out of Czechoslovakia. That needed a Gestapo permit, and that was very difficult for me to obtain. My father had made contact with a Czech citizen who worked for the Gestapo, and he got a permit. The only problem was it wasn't in my name. It was in someone else's name who, for whatever reason, I don't know, maybe had been killed or maybe had never picked it up for whatever reason, he had available. And so for some payment, I had that permit. So now I had a passport, I had an American visa, but the passport had my name, and this exit permit with a Gestapo stamp on it had another name on it. The Gestapo and the frontier police won't come through at the same time, and they won't therefore compare the passport with that Gestapo permit with its Nazi stamp on it. And that is exactly what happened. So eventually I had to escape via Poland. And my father, who was a banker, had a brother who had been a banker in Vienna for the big German bank called the Wiener Kreditanstalt. He waited for me at a railroad station in Krakow at 4 o'clock in the morning after a somewhat tense passage into Poland. After some time of standing around for half an hour before he got from Czech border into the Polish side and so on, in some tense moments, I passed over and met my uncle on the railroad station at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he gave me some money and a steamboat ticket for one of the two Polish boats called the Battery. And with that I could then, out of the port of Gdynia, which is next to the German port of Danzig, proceed into Halifax initially, but without stopping myself in Halifax, to New York, where a good American friend of mine who went to school with me in Vienna awaited me. Here my problem was that I didn't have a declaration of sponsorship, even though I did have a visa. So initially it was held up, everybody else with passports, etc., was asked to go through first. Everybody else had gone through, and my situation being questionable was being held aside for a while. I met two friendly officers sitting and asking me questions. So I told them my story, And as I say, by that time, everybody else had disappeared. And my good American friend, who went to school with me in Vienna for 2 years, came aboard, came right through the barriers and right to the ship side. And so while I gave him my story and I told him, oh, now here's my good friend and he's waiting for me. So rather than send me to Ellis Island, they let me go. And I went and entered the United States. I was drafted in March of 1941. I had a very low draft number. So I was drafted as an enlisted man. I was initially sent to Fort Knox, Kentucky, where I had basic training. That's armored. Therefore, I was sent to the Desert Training Center in California under Patton. But before long, It turned out that I had the chance to go to Officers Candidate School. But not as simple as that. I had to, first of all, I had to be naturalized. I had taken out first paper, which therefore made me eligible for the draft and for the Army. But I was not yet a U.S. citizen. So an Army sergeant took me out to San Bernardino County Jail. Courthouse. And within 10 minutes, I became an American citizen. Well, I wanted to be in the infantry. I wanted to be in the infantry because I loved skiing, and I was a good skier. So I wanted to wind up. I'd heard about the 10th Mountain Division, the ski troops, and that's what really wanted to get into. And fortunately did. So I had to go before a board because of my accent, and they asked me what I wanted to do. And I said I'd like to get in the 10th Mountain Division. It seemed logical to them. So unlike what you usually hear about the Army, I wound up in Colorado, Camp Hale, and I joined as a second lieutenant the 10th Mountain Division. It was very simple barracks, and after all, we were about 11,000 feet high, so it wasn't exactly the most comfortable quarters. No indoor toilets, but outhouses about 50 feet away, temperatures down to 40 degrees below. But nevertheless, I loved it. Most of the young guys like myself liked it. So every week, a different platoon was sent up from Camp Hale. And as far as the junior officers were concerned, the platoon leaders, to train them in crossing avalanche slopes safely, hopefully, and to find a night objective by compass between 12 o'clock and 4 in the morning, to make use of the tents we have and the equipment. We carried 65-pound packs with our tents, which were insulated against moisture, snowstorm, and frankly, we were much too heavy. In the insulation caused a lot of problem because of our breathing. It was all iced up in the morning. We put these platoon leaders and their platoons, different one every week, through rigorous training. But the five or six junior officers stayed up there in Camp Hale all winter long. So eventually we had a general's recommendation, the commanding general of Camp Hale was General Rolfe, R-O-L-F-E, so we had his recommendation for that type of duty. Well, initially, all the mountaineers and skiers of Dartmouth wanted to join the 10th Mountain Division, and many of them did. But when they ran out of those, they took others and eventually made the great mistake of bringing in some guys from Hawaii. And that didn't work out at all. They just couldn't stand it. They all felt sick. They all wound up in the hospitals. In the summer, of course, it was rock climbing and rappelling. And eventually I was asked to be sent up as a special detachment to Mount Rainier, where we did ice rescue work, like for people falling down in a crevasse. And I fell down in a crevasse, not intentionally, and not all the way, fortunately. But in those days, we didn't have the type of harnesses they use today for rappelling. And so you simply slung it over your shoulder, through your leg, and held it with the other hand. So one fine day, we were climbing up from the Olympic Lodge on Mount Rainier, further up into the glaciers. And the real experts, like Walter Prager and others from Austria and Switzerland, asked me to rappel down. Now, there are no trees up there, not even the rocks. So what they do is that we have to make an ice anchor. It was like building a snowman, only not as high, and then compacting it down with your hands. And then putting the rope which held you around that as an anchor. So it was a very hot day, and in July, and the rope started cutting into the anchor, and therefore it loosened around my shoulders, and I fell out of it, but it caught around my right knee. So now I was hanging head down the crevasse, and fortunately slim and strong and with very strong stomach muscles, I could lift myself up to grab the rope, first with one hand, then with both hands, and chin myself. And then, of course, he started pulling me, eventually got back up. I was with the my 10th Mountain Division from December until July, at which time I was up on Mount Rainier doing this ice experimental rescue work. And all of a sudden got a cable from Washington to report back to Camp Hale, pick up my equipment, and report to the first class of military government for company grade officers, which was in Fort Custer, Michigan. So that was the end of my beautiful days in the 10th Mountain Division. It was civil affairs, military government training for junior officers. And initially they wanted to make us MPs, which was strongly objected to. So instead of that, half of us wound up at Yale and half at Harvard University for a while. Another cable to report back to Washington. And now this was my fortunate port. I was flown to Europe, whereas the others had to go in these miserable troop ships. It was an exciting flight because it was an old DC-3. You simply sit along the side of the plane, parachute strapped to your back. With that time, a new branch of the army had been established, civil affairs, military government, civil affairs for the liberation of France, and military government for the occupation of Germany. So I was sent there to teach German. And that lasted, a very, very beautiful British Army estate, former estate, in Shrivenham, England, next to Wiltshire. And that lasted for a little while. And then I got orders again that separated me from the rest of the group. And as I say, I was flown to Europe, and that was a good part. But to teach German to the officers who would arrive by boat, and in other ways prepare them for the occupation. First, liberation of France. I spoke French, and the occupation of Germany. A colonel, full colonel, came, who recruited officers for civil affairs with the government for the 2nd Division. And he interviewed me, and even though I was only a second lieutenant, he liked my language qualifications, maybe among other things, I hope. And I joined the 2nd Division, 38th Infantry Regiment, and we were shipped to Swansea, England, where I was bigoted. Bigoted was a code word for super secret clearance for the invasion of Europe. They had big tents where they had the maps of Europe. And I knew that I was supposed to prepare. I was briefed for the landing on Omaha Beach. On the 30, we were supposed to take St. Lo. Well, we had much heavier resistance than we expected. And we didn't take St. Lo for about 5 weeks, by which time there was no civilian population left, but just rubble. But those were the fortunes of war. I came ashore on D+1. We waited on D-Day outside Omaha Beach in freighters. Eventually landed on D+1, walking down, climbing down these rope ladders and going into landing craft tanks. Walked along the cliff, one road leading to Saint Laurent, that the people from the 29th Division, who landed on D-Day, and the 1st Division, but in my section, 29th Division, were lying every, what shall we say, 6 to 10 feet, because they were so easily killed by Germans who were behind the hedgerows. All they had to do was dig a hole through the hedgerows, stick a machine gun through it, and it was tough to get to get over those hedgerows, even for the tanks, who eventually devised a way of cutting into them by ingeniously putting some sort of scissor-like things in front of them to cut into, because otherwise you go up at the tank on a steep embankment like that and they just hit you into the not armored underbelly. So this second day, I walked next to the commanding regimental commander, who was a lieutenant colonel at the time, Saint Laurent. I was next to him because I spoke French and I spoke German. And it helped, for instance, to question some of the captured German soldiers as to, you know, what the division was, how many men, and all that sort of thing. We would take the first little town, Saint-Laurent-sur-Mer, and didn't really find anybody. The population had fled, the mayor had fled, the fire department had fled. So my job now as civil affairs officer was to reorganize the town, the village, to find a man who could be fire chief if the fire chief had gone, to find a mayor if the mayor had fled. And that was it, that was it. And to post General Eisenhower's proclamation, which was done by my driver and by this interpreter guy, who was a grandson of Ibsen's. And then very often we didn't stay but a couple of hours and on we went, because the Germans were in pretty fast retreat at the time. I mean, this was liberation. Not like Iraq, it really was liberation. And as soon as possible, I mean, the mayor would call others around and they would sing the Marseillaise, and I spoke French, I had to join in singing the Marseillaise. Each Thérésie Forêt, the Germans had started putting on stronger resistance. And we had front lines again. So there we stayed for about 5 weeks. Because primarily, not so much because of the Germans, but because the weather was so poor that they couldn't get supplies ashore for quite a while. And the weather was so poor they couldn't do any bombing. So it was only after this first 5 weeks, I think it was, that when the weather cleared, that a wave of bombers came over, which darkened the sky and really bombed the lines in front of us. The Germans were caught in a pincer movement at Vire, which became called the Vire Gap, V-I-R-E Gap. To the north, of course, were the British. And later on from the south, up came Patton. After we broke through Vire, it was becoming pretty much of a German rout and a very fast advance on our side. Eventually, part of the 2nd Division was sent forward to take Paris. And another part, my 38th Infantry Regiment, under who was then Colonel Zwicker, and later became General Zwicker, was sent south to take Brest, which was still held by the Germans. You know, it had all the German submarine pens. Explain a battle like that. It was such a huge front that, you know, you would get stationary for 10 days or something. Well, supplies kept coming up and so on. It was a long front. It was a very long front, and Eisenhower didn't dare to advance any further without having supplies coming up and without being able to advance as a whole. I mean, individual parts could have moved forward, but not the whole front. Moved to Hufelies, and from there moved into the borderline of Germany and Belgium, where the Germans had built up all this heavy fortification, pillboxes. And my regiment came to a stop in a call called Rochat Krinkel. It was, Belgian side was called Rochat, the German side was called Krinkled. And there, actually, we were surprised and overwhelmed by these 12 panzer divisions who had secretly assembled. Our intelligence had gotten information that there were some noises there that were not easy to explain at all. But no great preparation were taken, and on December night, I think December 15th to 16th, these panzers broke through. It so happened that I had taken two French liaison officers back to 3rd Army headquarters, and then I heard there was something going on the front and maybe I should stay, wait, find out what's going on, but I said, no, I wanted to get back. So I got back as far as a crossroad in Crinkled, with all my equipment in Crinkled, and never got any further. Because by the time I got to this crossroad, German tanks were coming through, and I was just there in time to see one of them shot down by our anti-tank gun, and the Germans bailing out of it already aflame. We had been pulled out, actually, and prepared for an attack to take the Rio River dams. And a new division, a really green division, the 99th Division, had been put into our place on the front lines in the Schnee Eifel. And that's where the Germans made their breakthrough. Germans got stopped at the Meuse River, which they hoped to cross and divide the British lines from the American. And they did not get across the Meuse. But this created this huge bulge, which on the one end was the well-known nuts of General McAuliffe, wasn't it? Yeah. And on the northern end, we held, the 2nd Division held, its share in the Elsenborn Ridge. But the Germans broke through all the way between to the Meuse River, and that's created the bulge. After the Germans made their breakthrough, the 38th Infantry Regiment, and I think all of the 2nd Division, no, the 38th Infantry, withdrew what was called the Elsenborn Ridge. The division headquarters was in Saint Vith, V-I-T-H, in Belgium. And there we were stuck for months in Bergen, in my particular case, in the 38th Regiment, Infantry Regiment. And we were holed up all this time, practically, in a cellar, in a coal cellar, while the battle was going on. It was cold and we froze. And the very front lines. I mean, I was in a frontline regiment, but I was at regimental headquarters. I wasn't ducking into foxholes, but it was very miserable, really miserable time. Eventually, we closed the bulge and took some prisoners. And then we advanced fairly fast to the Rhine River. I think the town this side of the Rhine was Neumagen. And we were lucky. The 9th Division was able to capture a railroad bridge. Part of it had been blown, but part of it was enough to make tanks go over and establish a bridgehead on the other side of the Rhine. And with that also we could establish these pontoon bridges. And eventually the regiment, my jeep and others went over across next to the Remagen Bridge on these platoon bridges. I mean, that was a major barrier. So to be able to get those tanks across and establish a bridgehead by Remagen was a major achievement. After crossing the Rhine, we moved into the Ruhr German industrial area. We moved through Kassel, but very quickly didn't stay there. I remember going into one town, and in France I would always first contact the curé and who had all the information I needed. In Germany I would go and like to find a minister's house. And the first town after crossing the Rhine, I remember asking for that, and he was gone in the army, German army. And I talked to his wife, and I always remember her words. We had gone into these towns, we had the troops well under control. Rape was a real exception. I ran across it, but only much later, much, much later. But after we got to the Mulde River, and we waited for the Russians. So she talked to me and said, "Was für ein nobler Feind, what a noble enemy you are." Because we had our troops well under control. I mean, I don't know about all the exceptions. I know of one after we got to the Mulde River, where there was a rape case, which I had to investigate. But in general speaking, it wasn't like being hit by the Russian troops. We were already pulled out, put into Patton's army in the south. The 9th Army took over, a military government detachment took over. I had Patton in the desert, you know, initially. And I didn't like Patton. I mean, I didn't like his guts and whatever, his speeches. And I mean, he was a good general. I don't doubt that at all. And it probably takes Patton's to win wars. But from a soldier's point of view, we would love Bradley, General Bradley. We wouldn't love Patton. I didn't, personally. I served under him. By that time, we had reached early February. And things started looking up, things weather-wise and any other way. I think they were relieved, frankly. I sense no hostility. I sensed only relief, but others may feel differently. I think they were happy it was over. And, you know, and they were happy it wasn't the Russians. They really were. Because so many Germans fled and before the Russian troops ever reached them. You know, they were just one of our great problems later on in the government was with the refugees from the eastern zone of Germany. And from Lithuania and the other Baltic countries. It was really a big problem for us to would bypass many, many a town. The only next best thing I remember is stopping in a town, practically just like so many times for a few hours. And I was approached by a German who said, "Please, I have 30 beautiful German army dogs, well trained, in a kennel. How am I going to keep them alive?" I said, "Well, when I get through with mess, with lunch, I'll go with you." And I did. And he took me to that kennel. And I did try to arrange for some grains by talking to the Germans, shipment for them. But there behind barbed wire, I saw a beautiful German shepherd dog, among others. His teeth bared, looking like a wolf, but he was a beautiful creature. And I said, "I think I'd take him with me." And not knowing how he would behave, but they were so smart, he immediately knew I was his new master, and they didn't eat me up first night together. Harris. H-A-R-R-A-S, Harris. You know, they like a brief, sharp thing where you could see Harris, stop, and so on, something like that. And he was a beautiful dog and a very smart dog. And he would ride in the Jeep with me from there on. It was wonderful. It was just one of the really great experiences of my life. With Patton, we were involved in the liberation of southern Bohemia and eventually Pilsen. And here my good luck was, number one, I spoke Czech. Number two, I was 60 miles from Prague, from which I had escaped. A close bond very shortly was established between me and the Czech people. I made some very good friends, including some very nice ladies. They were so happy, you know, to be liberated. Our headquarters became the Pilsner Brewery, which was on the main road number 12, which led between Pilsen and Prague, just before I got into Pilsen, and had 12%, or was it 18%, I forget, export beer, and of course it was, and we took over that headquarters. The German army had withdrawn. A few soldiers stayed behind, I think with the intention of being taken prisoners and get out of it. We knew the army, they were getting pretty well treated by that time. So it was interesting to see we would go through this practically empty town. And all of a sudden you would get to a corner and you see three or four German soldiers throwing up their hands, wanting to be taken prisoner. It's a great year for us to see the war in Europe ended. The 2nd Division knew they would have to go back and maybe go to Japan, and at which point I was separated from the 2nd Division, the 38th Regiment, and reverted, as we called it, to our headquarters, military government headquarters, which was in Bad Homburg, north of Frankfurt. We had a good friend of mine who was at that time G3, who had been with me to a military government training in Fort Custer and so on. And at that point, I said, he asked me what I wanted to do. I said, well, I'd like to take over one of the detachment. He said, well, everything has been assigned except one small county called Wegscheid on the Danube. Danube, a rural county. That's all there is. I said, well, okay. So I was given, assigned two junior officers and I think four or five enlisted men in two jeeps, and took over the county of Wegscheid in Bavaria on the Danube. I had enough points to go home immediately because it was after the March of 41. But having been trained in military government, there was no question that my place was to stay on. And so that's why I took over this one remaining county in Germany, in Bavaria. Bruce was sent to Stuttgart in March of 46. She had been a wave and a Smith girl, but she wanted to see Heidi's country, and could be Austria, it could be Germany, but she wound up working as a secretary for the consulate in Stuttgart. And that's when I met her, in March, and she was going to go home because she was registered at Radcliffe, and her life had to go on, you know. It's a wonderful life over there. These German, these American girls over there, you know, they just partied every night. But she had to go back. So that's what she wrote home. But she also had to take one more trip to France with this army officer she had met, who happened to be me. So we took a trip to France. I had won the privilege to buy an American car, a big black Chevrolet. And that we used and we drove to France together, to the eventually through southern France and Aix-la-Chapelle and beautiful places, and then to Menton, which is the last town in France before you get to Italy, and stopped in Monte Carlo, and then again in Cannes, and from Cannes she called Scarsdale, New York, and said that, looks, maybe she wouldn't come back after all. And so that must have been, was it still March? It was probably March. But anyway, a couple of months later in May, we got married in Stuttgart. I had two assignments. I took over North Baden from military government, which was a great job to have. But before going home, I took over a large county next to Stuttgart called Nürtingen, took over a huge villa with huge grounds, which was owned by a machine tool manufacturer, a big one in Germany. So there we lived, and we had a cook and a maid and a gardener, and we hired a German trained nursemaid who took care of Jennifer, our oldest daughter. The army packed up everything you had acquired by that time in one of these huge containers, which was then put a shipboard and delivered to Scarsdale, New York. I was discharged as a major in this country. I stayed in the reserve. I'm now Lieutenant Colonel in the reserve. Changed my life. It's something I certainly wouldn't be without, wouldn't want to have been, to have missed. I would think that just the physical training of the 10th Mountain Division came handy, not only from D+1 to through 5 combats until VE Day in Czechoslovakia, but served me all my life. I'm glad I had the chance to go with a regiment and land on D+1. I very much felt this was my war. I wanted to be involved with that fully.